All rise. The Supreme Court for the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Pickering presiding.
We have new acoustic materials in the courtroom today, so you're in a venturesome mode with us doing part of it from Carson City, part of it from down here, and new IT equipment. But we have wonderful crew here helping us, so all should go well. The first case on calendar today is Gathright versus State, case number 90032. Each side has 17 minutes, and counsel for the appellant can reserve some time for rebuttal. The clock should be showing on the podium, I believe, so that'll show you what time you have left. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes.
Very well. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens on behalf of the appellant in this matter, DeAndre Gathright. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Mr. Gathright was convicted at a jury trial of several counts to include first degree murder, and which takes me to my first issue that I would like to address, and that is the theory of challenge to fight theory for first degree murder. That is the only theory upon which the jury unanimously agreed to convict Mr. Gathright of first-degree murder. And so in my sufficiency of the evidence analysis, I began to look at NRS 200.450 to get the elements of what all is involved in this somewhat unusual theory. It's to me, a little antiquated, comes out of the dueling days, perhaps. I don't know. But the NRS is consistent with the way the jury was instructed in this case, that number one, it requires a challenge to fight. Number two, there has to be an acceptance of that challenge. Number three, there has to be an actual fight. And then number four, death must ensue or a death result from this fight. What I didn't see in those elements was a mens rea element. And that took me to the Pimentel case, which this court published in 2017. And in that case, I found this language. Similarly to the felony murder rule, which provides that the intent to commit the underlying felony supplies the malice for the murder, the challenge to fight theory relies on a person's intent to fight to satisfy the mens rea requirement to prove murder. The challenge to fight theory, like initial intent to fight, must be found to sustain a murder charge under the challenge to fight theory. This does not create a strict liability crime. So there is a mens rea element there. The state disagrees with me in their brief, but my reading of Pimentel is pretty clear. There has to be this mens rea element to withstand. In that context, it was a First Amendment overbreadth challenge. And so I worked that into my analysis. It was not raised below. Jury was not instructed on any intent to fight. So I'd ask for plain error review by this court. And looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, I find several deficiencies here. I think we all can agree that there was evidence of a challenge to fight. The victim in this case, Christopher Brown, was intoxicated. He was high on methamphetamine. He's staggering down the street. And when my client, Mr. Gathright, comes strolling by and attracts the attention somehow of Christopher Brown, and Christopher Brown follows him and taunts him and challenges him and swears and curses and threatens and does all manner of words as Mr. Gathright continues to walk down the street. In an apparent attempt to challenge him to a fight. Now, he appears to be quite drunk and intoxicated, but that could be construed as a challenge to fight. But is there an acceptance by Mr. Gathright of the fight? And I say no. There was no acceptance. What Mr. Gathright did in response was turn and walk away. Several witnesses say that. He walks away, and Christopher Brown, the homicide victim, follows him down the street. We never have an acceptance. Now, the state relies on four words from a witness, Daryl Marshall, AKA Slim, who is also high on meth. This is a neighborhood where the witnesses and victims are all, and it's late at night, and this is the kind of people that we have out there, but he's quite intoxicated or under the influence. He walks by these two men in the street, and to him, he's hearing what sounds like a friendly encounter, a friendly conversation, and in that context, he hears my client, Mr. Gathright, say, "Just come over here," those four words. And upon that, the state wants to hang this element of that's an acceptance of a fight, and I don't think it is. I don't think that is sufficient, especially under Pimental, when we look at the First Amendment overbreadth issue, that we don't want to criminalize all speech. It has to be narrowed down somewhat. I don't think that evidences an intent to fight. It sounds like he's trying to get him, this drunk man, out of the road, perhaps, if that is what Mr. Gathright actually said. And there is some space of time from where the witness Slim hears this out at the intersection until Slim gets up to the doors of the convenience store and then hears the gunfire. So there's a big gap in what's going on out there between him hearing those four words and then the gunfire. I think that's insufficient as a matter of law to support an acceptance of a challenge to fight. But we also don't have an actual fight. Witnesses testified that no fists were thrown, no punches were landed. There was no eyewitness to say that there was a fight before gunshots just ring out. And you have to have an actual fight. What we have is maybe a challenge to fight, and we have gunfire, but we're missing some pieces here. There's insufficient evidence to say that they were engaged in some sort of fight, at which time Mr. Gathright pulls out a gun and
was the theory that there's a lot of back and forth on the motion to sever about whether or not the March 11th had the same victim and the same assailant, whether it was Gathright and Brown on March 11th and again on March 22nd. Does that tie into the issue of the meaning to ascribe to that, or had that kind of been dropped out when they concede on one of the counts?
Well, that's certainly a fear that I had and trial counsel had at the time, is that the jury would infer that because these two dissimilar events were joined in a common trial, that this unknown victim on the 11th was the same one in the homicide 11 days later, and that supplies some sort of motive or intention for the homicide that doesn't exist. My understanding and the evidence is the state has no reason to think that the victims were at all the same. Was okay. An entirely different victim, but there's a danger in the joinder of these two, and that was some prejudice that as to why it shouldn't have been joined, because it's prejudice to Mr. Gathright for that there's spillover prejudice between the two events. And you know, our analysis of the denial of the severance issue is frustrated by the judge, who did not give any explanation. It was a judge who just inherited the case suddenly when the prior judge had recused herself, and another judge had looked at this motion and said, hey, I think severance is probably proper and there ought to be an evidentiary hearing on this. And then, you know, the other judge inherits the case and suddenly there's no evidentiary hearing. They're listening to argument and a summary denial, and the state was told to prepare an order and they never prepared an order. And so now we're guessing at what the reasons were. And there's many reasons and rationales for why charges may be joined or not joined or separated. And we don't know. We're guessing at the rationale for that. And it frustrates an abuse of discretion analysis. So we really don't know what was going through the judge's mind.
Some courts elsewhere, other state courts, seem to say the degree of deference diminishes when you don't have a judge that shows their work on the record so that the reviewing court can look and say, yeah, I understand what the thinking process was and why this ended up where it was, and then it facilitates our review of it. Plus, I'm concerned that there's a bit of a Petrocelli issue going on here about cross-admissibility, and we don't have any clear understanding of what is the purpose for the cross-admissibility here. I'd appreciate your arguments on those points. I'm sorry, that's not more articulate.
Well, the state's theory is because the same firearm was used and they're charging Gathright in both incidents, that this shows evidence of his identification for the homicide. But the probative...
Is that genuinely in play, though? Don't they have video of him on both events?
That's my point. The probative value of identity is greatly diminished because they had Officer Hawkins, who looked at the surveillance tape and was supposedly able to identify him from his awkward gait because of a pre-existing injury, and she looked at the video and said, that's him. And we had Daryl Marshall Slim, who said that... you know, he may not have known the shooter at the time, but Gathright came back to him later and said, don't cooperate to the police, don't say anything to rat me out. So that's another identification. And then Jessica, the woman that was involved in this.
Kennedy.
Kennedy. She knew Gathright, and she identified him certainly as the man with whom the victim was having this discussion, or whom Christopher Brown was threatening as the two of them go down the street. She didn't see the gunfire, but she saw all of the argument up leading up to that, and there was Gathright. So the state had a lot of evidence of identity and didn't need it. The probative value is greatly diminished, and yet the prejudice is really high. The spillover prejudice is high there. Gathright's defense was he was admitting he was the shooter for the earlier incident, and his identity was much more clearly on the videotape from the earlier incident and with his buddy Lamonte, who had agreed to testify for the state. But he wanted to fight his identity as the shooter in the homicide. So a lot of spillover prejudice there, and I think that did impact the jury's verdict and viewing these incidents as showing that Gathright had a violent propensity. And I think a cleaner trial would have been to separate these two.
Mr. Owens, how do you address the state's argument that this was a common plan or common scheme between the 11th and the 22nd incidents?
Well, common plan, to my understanding, requires that they be for the purpose of accomplishing the same goal, and there's no interrelationship between these two events. They were in adjacent areas of the same neighborhood where Gathright lived and frequented a casino. One was in the commercial business area outside of a Speedy Mart, and like the intersection almost of a couple of public streets, while the earlier shooting was between some apartments in the property adjacent, where there was a brick wall and an alley that separated it from the Speedy Mart. So they're nearby. But I don't see them as having any kind of common goal. I mean, if the victims were the same, you would have that. The state cannot show that these were the same victims. We have no reason to think that. So I don't see the same goal. Common scheme is if they're idiosyncratic in nature. And it seems like in the homicide, Gathright was just the victim of somebody, a drunk man, that singled him out on the street and tried to provoke him. Whereas with the earlier shooting, Gathright is actually barbecuing in a courtyard and responds to some gunfire in his neighborhood. And we may not agree with his method of responding to it, but he draws down and shoots at the fleeing suspect, who remains unknown to this day, shoots at that car as it drives by. So I don't see any idiosyncratic similarities that would constitute this being a common scheme.
The ballistics showed that it was the same gun in both incidents, though, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Same gun, which only goes to identity and should not be an issue, I don't think. The other sufficiency of the evidence argument I had, importantly, was the attempt murder for that earlier shooting. I think the state's evidence only showed a different offense, which Gathright was also convicted of, and that is discharging a weapon at or into an occupied vehicle. And to get attempt murder, you got to have something more. It can't be that every time you shoot in an occupied vehicle, you're committing attempt murder. And the state didn't have anything more. Lamonte Mangum testified that Gathright fired his gun in the direction of this car as it fled. That's all we got. Gathright did not make any statements or admissions that he was trying to shoot specifically at the driver and attempt to kill the driver. We don't have the driver of that car. That suspect fled and has never been found. We don't know if that suspect was injured, whether he was shot, and we didn't recover his vehicle to know if Gathright was a good shot and actually hit the vehicle. So I don't know from what facts the state's going to derive this intent to kill over and above the other offense of shooting at an occupied vehicle. Importantly, the state did not respond to this in their brief. In my reply, I pointed that out and said I intend to take this as a confession of error under the Polk case. And they had a chance to remedy it, and they never have until here we are today. I ask that they not be allowed to be heard on the merits of that issue. I think they forfeited that.
And is it your contention that the district court should have given a limiting instruction on the theory of the two crimes being cross-admissible?
I think so. So the jury knows what the rationale is for including these two murders together, and that would have gone a long way to alleviate our concern that maybe the jury thought it was the same victim. If you got that issue going on, let the jury know that I'm admitting it solely for purposes of identity of the shooter because it's the same firearm. that at least gives the jurors some direction of how to use these things, other than just saying, well, it looks like Gathright is a violent person in this neighborhood and is maybe retaliating against this.
At what point in the proceeding did Gathright concede that he was the shooter on March 11th?
Well, I think in an opening statement, I believe defense counsel stood up and conceded the gross misdemeanor, which I say now is a lesser included offense of discharging a weapon in a public place or where someone might be endangered.
Thank you.
I'm running out of time, but I'm going to take 1 minute to address one other issue here, and that has to do with this lone holdout juror. That just troubled me a lot. I know the judge did not inquire into vote tally, but we still had a vote tally be disclosed to the judge, and juror 10 was identified as the lone holdout, that the vote was 11-1 guilty on first degree murder, and juror 10 was identified. And the way that was handled, I think, is too much pressure on juror 10, and we're inquiring into the deliberative process and having all these things discussed in open court that I think is very embarrassing to juror 10, created undue pressure on him, and he was never told under the Allen instruction to adhere to his honest beliefs and not succumb to the majority just to reach a unanimous verdict.
Do you have any case law that addresses, I mean, it sounded from the transcript like the district court judge deputized juror 4, the foreman, to go back and tell juror 10 that juror 10 needed to set aside the issue with respect to the death penalty. And I've not seen that kind of a deputizing like that without juror 10 ever being brought into the loop. And then we get the note from the jury that if that's the case, 10's on board with whatever they're doing. Do you have any case law that addresses that?
I don't. It's such an unusual situation. I did cite to some Ninth Circuit case law. I don't often agree with them, but they said there's no distinction if the judge solicits the vote tally or whether it's just inadvertently disclosed by the foreman, the coercive effect on that juror who's called out in open court is the same. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I'll add enough time to give you 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and I would ask that the clerk add the same time to your opponent. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Eckley Keach on behalf of the state of Nevada, the respondent in this matter. Before this court are 8 issues for your honors to consider, none of which merit reversal. The trial court did not abuse her discretion when she denied the defendant's motion for a mistrial. The trial court did not abuse her discretion when she denied the severance of the claims. The trial court did not abuse her discretion to deny defendant's request to call an unnoticed expert mid-trial. Sufficient evidence supported the guilty verdict for first-degree murder under a challenge to fight theory. Sufficient evidence supported the guilty verdict for attempt murder. There was no plain error for the state to charge 2 separate counts of discharging a weapon where a person might be endangered and discharging a firearm into an occupied vehicle. And there was no plain error where the trial court dismissed the juror who refused to follow the law. Because there is no error, there is no cumulative error. But even if this court were to find that there was an error in the record, any error should be deemed harmless because the evidence of the defendant's guilt in this case is overwhelming. The defendant was seen on video committing the murder, the discharging of the attempt murder. Eyewitnesses testified to the defendant having committed the murder, attempt murder, and dischargings. The defendant confessed to the murder to 2 separate witnesses. Ballistic forensics connected defendant's same gun to both shooting scenes. And evidence from the Eureka Casino, including the defendant's Players Club records, placed the defendant at both scenes at both of the crimes. And for these reasons, the state is going to request that this court affirm the verdict in its entirety. I'd like to start with the argument that the state has forfeited the attempt murder charge. The appellant has argued under Polk that the state has forfeited that charge. Polk turns on harmless error. Harmless error is on a respondent, the burden is on the respondent to make the argument for harmless error because there's an error and the respondent has to justify why it's harmless. That's not what we're arguing here. The issue before the court here is a separate matter. It's sufficiency of the evidence. That is a review that the court undertakes independently of arguments by the parties. And so to the extent that the state, that the respondent hasn't addressed it, that doesn't obviate this court's obligation to still review the charge under the proper standard, which is sufficiency of the evidence. In this case, because courts independently apply the Jackson versus Virginia, which is the sufficiency of evidence standard, on appellate review. And that's from Mitchell versus State, 124 Nevada, 807 at page 816 from 2008. Under that standard, the sufficiency of the evidence standard, view of the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, a rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of attempt murder beyond a reasonable doubt. On video and in eyewitness testimony, the defendant hid behind a row of cars, waited for the other car that he targeted to drive by. When that car drove by, he jumped out, the defendant, from behind those cars and discharged six shots into that vehicle. That's found on appellant's record, page 1640. The repeated shooting, as well as the fact that he waited to shoot into the car, demonstrated his intent to kill that driver. And so when the jury heard that evidence, when they saw the video showing the defendant sitting and waiting behind the cars for the other car to drive by, and then they heard Lamonte Mangum, the co-conspirator, also testify, yeah, he was shooting at the car, it is sufficient that a rational trier of fact could have taken that evidence, the videographic evidence, as well as the testimonial evidence of somebody else who was complicit in the event, and find that the defendant, when he shot six times at that car, intended to kill that driver. The fact that the driver wasn't found, and the fact that the car wasn't located, and the fact that the body is still alive, presumably because he was never found, those aren't elements of attempt murder. The elements of attempt murder are the effort to, with the intent to kill, but failing to do so. And that's what happened here. That's what was presented to the jury, and the jury came back with a valid verdict for attempt murder. I'd like to go to the sufficiency of the evidence under the challenge to fight theory.
Mr. Keats, hang on a second. Is there a reason the state didn't respond to that in their answering brief?
Thank you, Justice Bell. Unfortunately, I think that the state just has to fall on the sword on this. In speaking with our appellate unit, I believe that it was just overseen or overlooked by the appellate attorneys. There's no reason why. It certainly wasn't an intentional forfeiture on our part. It's not a concession that the attempt murder isn't validly sustained. It's simply just one of those situations where the drafter of the argument failed to include it and oversaw or had an oversight in it. However, as I mentioned, the cases relied upon by the appellant in this Polk go to harmless error, which is the burden of the respondent to prove and would have been a forfeiture, but this court has its own independent obligation to review the sufficiency of the evidence in making its determination, which the state believes was met in this case. Going to the challenge to fight issue, the jury was properly instructed as to what the elements of challenge to fight are. I'd like to start by first saying, even in Pimentel does not say the challenge to fight has a specific intent component, because challenge to fight is not a specific intent crime. What Pimentel discussed, and the import of Pimentel, was that in looking at the challenge to fight, is it constitutional to be able to charge a challenge to fight, or would such conduct be protected under the First Amendment as protected speech? And so it goes through the analysis, the same as fire in a theater analysis. And what Pimentel holds is that the significance of the speech is the context in which it was uttered. That's a far cry from the court saying or requiring that challenge to fight have a specific intent element. It does not. Neither the legislature, nor the NRS, nor Pimentel indicate that challenge to fight is a specific intent crime. What it says is facially present on the face of the NRS. If a challenge is conveyed and accepted, and death results as a result of that challenge to fight, either given or accepted, that operates similarly to a felony murder and is sufficient for murder to be found in the case.
Mr. Keats, assuming you're correct on that point, can you address the evidence in this case? Like, what was the challenge to fight?
Absolutely. So in this case, and again, if we're looking under the sufficiency of the evidence standard, we first have Jessica Kennedy. Jessica Kennedy, for all intents and purposes, is the defendant's girlfriend. He's living with Jessica after the murder occurs. Prior to the defendant coming onto the scene, Jessica is engaged in an ongoing conversation with the victim, Christopher Brown. They're talking, Jessica indicates that Christopher is flirting with her, trying to take her out to eat pancakes, and then the defendant arrives on the scene. He comes into the gas station near the car on the side of the gas station where Jessica and the victim, Christopher Brown, are talking. It's at that point that Christopher Brown begins aggressively going after the defendant verbally, saying things that this is going to be your last night here, kiss your kids goodbye, making multiple threats to attack them, to the point where Jessica has to intervene between the defendant and Christopher Brown. She gets in between them to break up a fight that was imminent to occur as a result of the argument and the aggressive threats that are being made between the parties by Christopher Brown and DeAndre Gathright. Jessica Kennedy stands.
Can I pause you for a moment?
Yes.
What threats were made by Gathright?
I apologize. I believe I misspoke on that, Justice Pickering. I believe that at that point it was the threats made by Christopher Brown to Gathright, which it included that the defendant said he was going to, quote, whoop his ass. And that's on the appellate record, page 978. And so it's during these threats shouted by Christopher Brown at Gathright that as they're approaching, and you see this on video, Jessica Kennedy also testified to this, she had to get in between Gathright and Brown to avoid a fight from occurring. At that point, Gathright told Jessica, go back into your car. And so at that point, Kennedy goes back into her car. And at that point, as Brown is engaged in this threatening to the defendant, they're going down the alley. And that is when Daryl Marshall overhears Gathright say, just come over. And so in the context of everything that had happened, in the context of a fight having been broken up by Kennedy, Gathright instructing Kennedy, who had broken up the imminent fight, to go back into her car, that immediately after that, they walk down the same alley about 40 yards, not very far, within the same complex of the gas station. At that point, Gathright says, just come over. And then, in response to that, Brown comes over and Gathright shoots him. The jury validly considered the context in which that statement was made as either an independent challenge to fight, given that this was during the heat of the threats that had been made by Brown, or an acceptance of Brown's prior challenge to fight, which included Jessica testifying specifically that Brown was going to whoop his ass. And so, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, given the context in which all of these statements were being made, the clear threats made by Brown, the fact that an imminent fight was broken up by Kennedy, the fact that the defendant instructed Kennedy to go into her car after she had broken up the fight, and that within this same course of conduct, he leads him down a few yards, tells him to come over here, and then as he comes over here, shoots him, that is sufficient for the challenge to fight and acceptance of the challenge to fight and for the jury to find that he was guilty.
So does this...
Correct. There is no law.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, Justice Pickering or Justice Perry, could you move your microphone over because we can't hear you over here. Thank you.
Okay. Is that better?
So much better. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Perry. To go directly to your point, there is no law, and the NRS does not say that there is a quantum of punches that need to be thrown in order to define what a fight is. Again, the guidance that this court has given us in challenge to fight is that you need to look contextually at when the words were uttered, and you need to look contextually at the entire scene. In this case, the first punch, so to speak, that was thrown was when DeAndre Gathright pulled out his gun and shot. The fact that that was the first physical contact in the fight doesn't obviate the fact that a fight had occurred. It's just that the deadly force was the first force engaged in during the course of that fight.
Mr. Keech, does the defendant have to be the person making the challenge?
No, and the NRS is clear on challenge to fight that it can either be the person who makes the challenge or accepts and receives the challenge to fight. In this case, the defendant saying, just come over here, could be construed either way, given the context in which it happened. For the state, the fact that the defendant had sent away the person who had broken up an imminent fight and then immediately walked yards down the alleyway and said, come over here, indicates a separate intent to fight. But it's equally contextualized within this event that's occurring, that he is accepting Brown's prior challenge to fight, including him saying whoop his ass, by accepting that and saying just come over here at that point, because it had happened in the contemporaneously with everything else that was going on during these threats.
Does that argument illustrate the argued prejudice from the joinder of the two counts? Well, there are four counts, but the March 11th and March 22nd events. It seems sort of like it does, because if you have what you describe as ambivalent or ambiguous words, but a history of aggression when crossed and maybe even involving the same victim, I could see that there could be a crossover prejudice from the two being tried together. Could you comment on that?
Sure. So in terms of, just for clarity of the record, because I know that Justice Pickering, you asked this as well for the appellant, that there's no evidence deduced that the individual from the attempted murder was the same person who was killed on the murder scene.
Right.
In terms of the prejudice inferred, I don't think that there's a risk of crossover prejudice that the defendant has a violent tendency and that's the reason why the jury came back with the challenge to fight. If that was the case, I think the jury would have very clearly in the special verdict form on first degree murder found him guilty of both premeditated and challenge to fight, but they didn't. They deliberated on both points and they explicitly found guilty as to challenge to fight, not guilty as to premeditated. If they were going to go along and say he's just a violent person and he does this, he had thought about wanting to kill because of what had happened based on the evidence on the 11th, they likely would have checked both or would have checked premeditated and deliberate. That one militates toward a person with a violent tendency, premeditation to kill. They didn't find that. What they found was challenge to fight. And that's based on the clear evidence here that there effectively was going to be a fight that was broken up. And immediately afterward, the defendant had led the victim a few feet down the alleyway, said, just come over here, pulled out his gun and shot him. And so that is how the jury came around to it. Not because they had heard the evidence of the 11th. I think the special verdict on that point alleviates the predominant concern of crossover prejudice with respect to that.
Mr. Keach, that seems to contradict the state's argument about common plan and or scheme, though. Could you address that?
Yes. So identity was a central part of this case. And the fact that the defense had conceded in trial the gross misdemeanor doesn't mean that they were conceding identity. In fact, it was a specific tactic by defense to concede to identity on the lesser charge in order to try and defeat the main charge, which is the murder charge. Very clearly, throughout the trial, the identity of Gathright as the murderer was what was being attacked by the defense. It was the focus of the defense's closing, and it was a necessary thing that the state had to be able to establish and had to be able to prove clearly, because identity was such a central part of the trial and such a central part of the defense as to the murder charge.
All right, hang on just a second. So my question was, we don't have an order, we only have the opposition to the motion to sever, where the state argues that there was a common plan or a common scheme. So not identity, but common plan or scheme was what I was asking about.
Right. So I think, Your Honor, the two necessarily come together in this. And I will say, for the argument that Judge Leavitt just summarily heard summary arguments and then ruled off the cuff, even during the argument, defense counsel put on the record that she had assumed that the trial judge, Judge Leavitt, had read the briefings before she said she was going to merely respond to the state's argument. At that point, obviously, had Judge Leavitt not read the briefing, she could have said, no, actually, I haven't. Can you give me the full arguments? Or, no, we need to reset this so that I can read the briefings. But it was put on the record explicitly by defense counsel that I assume you have read the briefings, and so I'm going to make arguments supplementary to that. And there was never a question raised by the defense up until the appeal as to whether Judge Leavitt had fully considered the import of the severance and the opposition of the severance. during the trial or during the briefings.
To be clear, I don't doubt that she read all of it. We just don't know what her reasoning was for denying it.
Well, in reading the hearing and reading the context in which Judge Leavitt ordered the state to prepare the order, I believe that Judge Leavitt had intended to adopt the state's argument in full. And what the state had argued was that the crimes are connected together, one of the theories for joinder, connected together through the same firearm being used, through the same neighborhood, through his frequent visits to the Eureka Casino. And we made those arguments in our briefing, and that's on the appellate record on page 23. And we had argued that it was a common scheme because of the defendant's repeated and frequent use of the firearms in the neighborhood around the same time, so within 10 days of each other. And so that's on page 24 of the appellate record. That's from our briefing on that issue.
Is that enough, Mr. Keach?
Well, I think that's a question under abuse of discretion. And so if the trial judge has followed the NRS, which said a joinder is appropriate where they're connected together or a common scheme, then whether it's enough is a sufficiency question that the judge makes a determination on. And certainly for Judge Leavitt, she made the determination that it was. She had the opportunity to say that it wasn't. And in this case, she said she agreed with the state and asked the state to prepare the order. One of the other reasons that identity was so important here, and it was something that was brought up briefly but not fully addressed, the firearm was never found. The defendant's firearm was never found. And so all we had to rely upon was the circumstantial evidence of the ballistics, his attendance at the Eureka Casino, and the testimony of the eyewitnesses with respect to that. Of course, we have video. It's not high-definition video, but we have video of the act occurring. But because we didn't have the gun, it was also significant that during the two investigations, there was able to draw a connection between the ballistics found on the firearm or on the ammunition that was found at both scenes. And so that was another significant reason why the state believed that joinder was appropriate here and not more prejudicial than it was probative. Finally, just briefly, the state during the trial had cited a litany of Ninth Circuit, Second Circuit, United States Supreme Court cases, as well as McKenna versus State, that justified Judge Leavitt dismissing the juror who indicated he couldn't follow the law, and so it was appropriate for her to dismiss the juror at that point.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Well, I don't know why Polk wouldn't apply to the confession of error. It applied to me. I was the prosecutor in that case. I didn't like it at the time. But you know what? We didn't make that mistake again. I learned from that. And whenever the defense pointed out in their reply that we had, because we're human, we missed an issue, I would cure it. And the Supreme Court was willing to let us cure it and file an amended answer and get our response on the record. My reply pointing out confession of error was filed in August of last year. And they've never, to this date, decided to supplement their pleadings, and yet they want to be heard here today in argument. I think it's only fair that the Polk apply and their argument not be considered. As to the challenge to fight theory, whether we call it a specific intent to fight or not, there has to be a mens rea element of an intent to fight. And the jury was not instructed about that. Just like felony murder requires an intent to commit the underlying felony from which we can imply malice to get us to first-degree murder, so too with the challenge to fight theory, you have to find an intent to fight in order to imply malice to again get to first-degree murder. This court has addressed other situations where we blur the lines between first and second-degree murder. I think in Sharma and Bolden, it dealt with accomplice liability, aiding and abetting and conspiracy, but we really need to narrow down those elements because challenge to fight is, it could be abused, it could be overbroad, and I think it's being overbroadly applied here. Anytime you have some fighting words and a gunfire, boom, suddenly it's first degree murder. And I don't think that's what the legislature intended. We have to stay true to these elements and the First Amendment limitation of a mens rea of intent to fight. And I don't think they've got enough here from which a reasonable jury could conclude that this was in the context of an actual fight taking place. The relationship of the parties is really odd, and I don't know that I agree with all the facts that the state put forward here because these witnesses were not forthcoming with the nature of the relationship. To my understanding, Jessica did not become Gathright's girlfriend until after the homicide. That was my reading of the record, At the time of the homicide, Jessica was seeing the victim, Christopher Brown. She didn't tell the police that, but she had his phone number, his contact in her phone, and had an hour, hour and a half long conversation with him just shortly before this incident out there with the homicide. So the credibility of some of these witnesses and the interplay is not always clear from the record, so I don't know that I see it the same way the state does. And I don't remember Jessa breaking up some sort of imminent fight, that there was a fight. My recollection of the record is that from the get-go, yes, Gathright told Jessica to get in the truck because he was concerned for her, but then he walked away. He did not confront Christopher Brown. I don't remember there being some sort of quick fight that was broken up and then that it continued on down the street. He's doing his best to walk away. And when they say Gathright leads him, there's nothing for, he wasn't holding Christopher Brown's hand, dragging him down the street. Gathright's walking away. Christopher Brown is choosing to follow, continuing with the taunts, and we don't have any evidence that Gathright was taunting him back. Then we might have an agreement to fight, but we don't. And so I ask for this court to grant the appeal. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We'll be briefly in recess and then resume the bench in a few minutes. Thank you very much. We'll stand adjourned.
Thank you.